My name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 149. I'm recording it on Monday, July 20th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this selection is Fire Song. The title of the podcast is Rebalancing Never Works. If you were going to reduce the message of all the investing materials at PassionSaving.com, probably about 100 articles, 149 podcasts, 4 unique calculators, blogs, hundreds of blog entries. If you were to reduce all that work to 3 words, these would be the three words that are the title of this podcast. Rebalancing never works. What's different about PassionSaving.com is that the academic research has shown for 28 years now that valuations affect long-term returns. That research was done by Robert Shiller. Many others have confirmed it in the time since. But Robert Shiller is the first that I know of. I give him credit for it. In 1981, if valuations affect long-term returns, passive investing, which is staying at the same stock allocation at all price levels, obviously cannot work. Because the most important thing that an investor does to affect his long-term success is decide on his stock allocation. If you go with the right stock allocation, everything else is going to work out, most likely. If you go with the wrong stock allocation, it's hard to come up with too many scenarios in which you'll end up ahead. That's the make or break decision. You've got to come up with the right stock allocation. And if you invest, since valuations affect long-term returns, as I say, we've known this for 28 years, since valuations affect long-term returns, obviously you want to be at a different stock allocation at different valuation levels, because the risk of stocks is different at different valuation levels, and the return on stocks is different at different valuation levels. So it makes zero sense to be at the same stock allocation, and that's what passive investing means. To invest passively means the thing that passive investors are passive about is their stock allocation. So what makes the investing, I don't even want to say advice, but the investing discussions different at PassionSaving.com is everything done at PassionSaving.com starts from the assumption that passive investing makes zero sense. We instead follow a model we call rational investing, which is the model that accepts what the academic research of 28 years says, that you must change your stock allocation if you want to have any realistic hope of long-term success as an investor. That's controversial. It's controversial. It's controversial because the idea that it's not necessary, that valuations don't affect long-term returns. If the market were efficient, the market would always be properly priced and valuations would have no effect. If the market were efficient, as is assumed by the advocates of the passive investing model, overvaluation couldn't even exist. It's the full truth of the matter. Overvaluation and undervaluation are impossible in an efficient market, because in an efficient market, things are priced properly. That's the whole idea. That's what efficiency means. So there's no such thing. Obviously, if there's no such thing as overvaluation or undervaluation, there's no need ever to change your stock allocation. And passive investing makes perfect sense. So all of this turns on the question of whether the academic research of the past 28 years, of which there is now a mountain of evidence in support, is correct, or whether the passive idea is correct. And for the passive idea, no one has ever come up with a rational argument in support of it, and no one has ever come up with any time period in the history of the United States in which passive investing worked. So You know, you could argue I'm drawing that contrast strongly, but that's what I believe. I don't believe there is any evidence for passive investing. I believe it was a mistake. I believe it was a mistake. The passive model follows from a belief in the efficient market. The efficient market theory was indeed a breakthrough in our understanding of how stock investing works, but it was a first cut. It was a first draft at developing a model of understanding how stock investing works that would be based on academic research. And the researchers are human like everybody else. They jumped to some hasty conclusions. They made a mistake. None of that is of any great importance in my view. Humans make mistakes all the time. It's just part of the game. The trouble is that as the mistake has become more and more evident, especially from the mid-1990s forward, when it's become alarmingly evident that this was all a big mistake, the stock selling industry has been highly reluctant to acknowledge this mistake, and most quote-unquote experts have continued to advocate passive investing even in the face of a mountain of evidence that valuations affect long-term returns. Evidence that many of the passive investing advocates themselves acknowledge. Bill Bernstein is a big passive investing advocate. Bill Bernstein says in his book that the fact that valuations affect long-term returns is a mathematical certainty. Mathematical certainty. I don't know how you could get any stronger than that. John Bogle is Mr. Passive Investing. John Bogle is the one who taught me how stock investing works by reading. I learned by reading his book. John Bogle often talks about reversion to the mean. Reversion to the mean is a nonsense concept in a world in which the market were efficient, in a world in which valuations did not matter. So that's the background. Now, there was a poster who came to the blog the other day. The blog is called Rich Life. And he asked the question. He asked me about rebalancing. And I jumped in and said, you know, rebalancing is a disaster. And it just hit me. I mean, this is self-evident, really. But it just hit me. Rebalancing is just passive investing. The two are virtually synonyms. The only difference is passive investing is the model, and rebalancing is the practical implementation of that model. If you rebalance, you are a passive investor. That's you're staying at the same stock allocation deliberately. It's not an accident. You're not messing up. You're trying to stay at the same stock allocation. As crazy as that is, as self-destructive as that is, as horrible an idea as that is, that's what you're doing. You're investing passively. If you're rebalancing, you are investing passively. There's just no getting around it. The two are essentially the same thing. To rebalance is to invest passively. If you want to invest passively, you have to rebalance. It's the only way to invest passively. Because the whole idea of rebalancing is to stay at the same stock allocation. What rebalance means is if you're at a 70% stock allocation and stocks go up during the course of a year strongly, you could end up with a stock allocation of more than 70%. So you sell a little bit in order to get your allocation back down to 70%. And it works the other way. If stocks go down too much, your allocation would go below 70%, and you would buy stocks to get back to 70. The whole idea of rebalancing is to get to the stock allocation you were at before. And that means keeping your, what you're trying to do if you rebalance once a year, what you're doing is you're pulling your allocation back to that same level once a year. You're always returning to that allocation, whatever it happens to be, 70% or 60% or 50, whatever it happens to be, 80, whatever it is. You're always returning to that same allocation, which means you're investing passively. The thing that passive investors are passive about is their stock allocation. So what I'm trying to do in all the work I do on investing issues at PassionSaving.com is to explain to you why, you know, I usually say why passive investing is a bad idea. I could just as easily say I'm trying to explain why rebalancing is a bad idea. I'm trying to explain why investing rationally is the way to go and why setting your allocation an evaluation-informed way is the way to go. The alternative to passive investing, the alternative to the passive investing model is rational investing. It's rational to change your allocation in response to changes in price. Since the value proposition is so different with changes in price. And the way to implement rational investing is through a valuation-informed strategy, which means when prices go up, when stock valuations increase, you want to be lowering your stock allocation. And when prices go down, when stock valuations go down, and the value proposition is strong, you want to be increasing your stock allocation. So you can sum up everything I've said in 149 podcasts, most of them over an hour in length, in three words. Rebalancing doesn't work. Rebalancing doesn't work. That's the message. That's what we're trying to teach middle class investors. When middle class investors learn that rebalancing doesn't work, they will be investing rationally, which means they will be able to retire 5 years sooner. That's what the historical data shows. The calculators at the website use the historical stock return data as their engine, and if you work those calculators, you will see that by investing rationally instead of passively, by investing in evaluation, following a valuation-informed strategy rather than a rebalancing strategy, you can retire, in most cases, roughly 5 years sooner than would be possible if you were rebalancing. And if we could only get that message out, we could bring this economic crisis to an end, because the problem, the core problem that we're suffering from in the economy is a loss of confidence in the market. And that's spreading. It's becoming a loss of confidence in our economic system, and there's signs it may even become a loss of confidence in our political system. Let's hope it does not go there, but there are signs in that direction. People are becoming discouraged because they've lost so much of their retirement money, and they lost so much of their retirement money because they were investing passively, and they were investing passively. They were following a rebalancing strategy because this has been pushed as the conventional wisdom for 30 years now. The stock selling industry has spent hundreds of millions of dollars promoting this idea that is wrong, and that we know is wrong by looking at the academic research and the historical data. So I want to, when this fellow asked me this question, I thought, boy, rebalancing doesn't work. I always like to make things as simple as I can make them. Rebalancing doesn't work says it all. Why not do a podcast, Rebalancing Doesn't Work, and try to go through some illustrations of why. Why does rebalancing not work? What's so bad about rebalancing? Let's see if we can look at that. Now, usually when I'm discussing this on a discussion board or at a blog somewhere, I try to use dramatic examples to make the case as clearly as possible. And I think the dramatic example, you couldn't make it any more clear. I'll tell you my standard dramatic example. In 1982, the PE10 level, PE10 is the price of stocks. It's the price of a broad index over the average of the last 10 years of earnings. If you want to know more about PE10, there's a podcast entitled PE10 Rocks. PE10 is the magic tool that tells you whether stocks are priced to perform, to provide a good long-term return or a poor long-term return. That's what PE10 tells you. So when the obvious, well, it's obvious, but I better say it. When the long-term return is poor, you should be going with a low stock allocation. That's controversial. You're not allowed to say that in a lot of places. When the long-term return is good, you should be going with a high stock allocation. And poor and good are relative to whatever alternate asset classes are available. So if you can get a better long-term return out of certificates of deposit, you should be going with certificates of deposit, not stocks. Certificates of deposit have beaten stocks since 1994. Why? Because stocks were insanely overpriced from 1995 forward. That's why. buy an asset that's insanely overpriced, what would you expect? You expect to get a good return? The stock selling industry will tell you that it's always a good time to buy stocks and you can never buy too many. Well, isn't that what every industry tells you? Doesn't the car industry tell you it's always a good time to buy a car? Doesn't the movie industry tell you it's always a good time to see a movie? Just because the industry trying to sell you something tells you, it doesn't make it so. To know whether stocks really offer a good long-term return or not, you need to look at the historical data. There is no other way. You need to look at the historical data, gain a sense of the likely long-term return, and make your stock allocation accordingly. So I have a calculator at the website entitled the Stock Return Predictor. And this calculator tells you all you have to do is plug in the PE10 level that applies at the time you're thinking of buying stocks, and it tells you what the most likely 10-year return is for that. And it tells you the range. It tells you the most likely number, and then it tells you the range of possibilities and what the various percentages are for those returns. And the calculator is set up. It's default results. You don't have to enter anything. It'll give you today's numbers. And if you want to look at, you know, different numbers, what will happen if we have a 50% drop in price, or what will happen if prices go up, you can plug in those P10 numbers and get the answers for those numbers. So it's an essential tool. I don't think anyone should buy any stocks without checking out the stock return predictor. That's how strongly I feel about it. And I think that there should be hundreds of stock return predictors all over the internet so that we had some competition for the calculator that I put together with John Walter Russell. And the more competition we have, the better, because the tools will get better. Now, in 1982, the P10 level, the price of stocks, since I mentioned John, let me mention his website, because I want all of my listeners to check out John's website. You need to check out his website if you're thinking of buying stocks at any time in your life, because you can't do it without knowing the ABCs. And John does the research that helps us to understand the ABCs. John's website is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. It's a wonderful website. John is a wonderful resource for the indexing and retire early discussion board communities. And read the letters to the editor at his site, and you'll see a lot of middle-class people like yourself reporting the wonderful experience they've had checking out John's site and learning from his research, which is all provided for free, this wonderful communications tool we have called the internet. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's been misused by many, but it has its wonderful, wonderful aspects. And John's site, in my humble opinion, is the most important website on planet internet. So says Rob Bennett. So, 1982, the P10 level was 8. That's a fantastic P10 level. Fantastic. The number you get for the most likely annualized real return. Annualized real return is how much you're going to get on average for 10 years running. You're not going to get this number every year, but it's going to average out to something in this neighborhood, most likely. The most likely annualized real return in 1982 was 14.5%. Let's call it 14% real. That means your money's going to increase. Your stock portfolio is going to increase by 14% every year for 10 years running. That's how you get rich. That's how you retire early. You wanted to be invested in stocks in 1982. How about 1999, the end of 1999? 18 years later. Then the P10 level was 44, the highest number on record by far. We've never gone anywhere close before. Highest we had ever gone before that was 33, and that was the month before the Great Depression hit. The great stock crash that led to the Great Depression of 1929. But this time we went to 44. Gives you some idea of what we've got to look forward to as a result of this passive investing nonsense that we've been pushing on people, shoving down people's throats for 30 years now. Most likely 10-year return, the end of 1999. 18 years later, negative 1%. So, if you put your retirement money in stocks, you're likely to lose 1% real per year for 10 years running. Every year, you'll be a little farther behind on your retirement goals. For your entire portfolio, not just the new money you put in, the entire portfolio is going to go down every year for 10 years. Now, it's not going to literally go down every year. There will be some years it goes up. But in the years it goes down, it will be greater than the amount it goes up. So that overall, that's the likely number. And of course, it could be worse. That's the most likely number. Could be better, but it could be worse. Do you see the difference? Now, tell me, if you have practiced rebalancing, please riddle me this, Batman. What stock allocation makes sense both at a time when the most likely long-term return is a positive 14.5% and also when the most likely long-term return is a negative 1%? What stock allocation makes sense in those two circumstances? Well, when stocks are providing a negative real return, I suppose you could argue 0% stocks makes the most sense. TIPS were available, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, paying 4% real in late 1999. So you could have beaten the stock return by 5 full percentage points every year for 10 years running just by putting your money into TIPS. So let's say 0 is best. Now, I don't recommend 0 because I think it's better to always have something in stock. So I recommend maybe 20% at those price levels. But if you go just by the numbers, be 0. How about when the return? How about when it's 14.5? Well, at 14.5, you ain't going to beat that in CDs. That's 14.5 real. You ain't going to beat that with TIPS. So going by the numbers, 100%. Maybe in real life, you'd go with 80 or 90. It's hard for me to imagine going with 100. I could never go with 100% stocks, and I don't recommend that you do. But going by the numbers, 100% would certainly make sense. Going by the numbers, it would make sense to borrow. I did a podcast recently. Jeremy Siegel says that you should borrow to buy stocks. Well, when the long-term return is 14.5 real, I think he's got a good point. I wouldn't do it. And I discussed that in the podcast. But by the numbers, certainly makes sense. Okay, so 0% makes sense on the numbers at 1999. 100% makes sense by the numbers. 1982. If you're going by what you would really do, then maybe 20% makes sense in 1999, and 80-90% makes sense 1982. Well, if you rebalance, what are you gonna do? You're gonna go with, if you go with 100% in 82, that means you're gonna be at 100% in 1999 when the long-term return's a negative number. If you go with 0% in 99 and you rebalance, that means you're gonna be going with 0% in 1982, or the next time valuation levels are at that level, and you're gonna be going with 0% when the long-term return is 14.5 real. Does that make any sense? Now, it makes zero sense. Zero sense. Zero sense. Don't rebalance. Please. You'll make me cry. I don't like to see middle-class investors lose their money. Don't rebalance. If anybody tells you rebalancing is a good idea, please point out to them what the historical data says. Please point out to them what the stock return predictor says. And if they have a good comeback, please let me know. I want to know if there are any flaws with this calculator. I want to hear about them. No one's discovered any significant ones yet. There are little things. And I have a podcast where I talk about the pros, the cons of valuation-informed indexing. There are things we don't know. There are uncertainties. There are caveats that apply. But there's nothing to justify rebalancing that I know of, for sure. Okay, so rebalancing is insane. I don't say the people who practice it are insane. My listeners mostly practice it, my readers. I love them all. They're not insane. They're good people. They're smart people. The experts recommend it. They're good people. They're smart people. But they follow a stock investing strategy that is insane. I think that's fair to say. Not trying to hurt their feelings, but rebalancing is insane. It's a mistake. It's rooted in something called the efficient market theory, which is a mistake. It's been discredited. It's the biggest mistake ever made in the history of personal finance. Rob Arnott, former editor of the Financial Analyst Journal, the most prestigious journal in the field, said recently, the conventional investing wisdom of today is mostly myth and urban legend. Myth and urban legend. That's rebalancing. It's all myth and urban legend. There's nothing to it. Makes no sense. It's good marketing. It's good marketing. People love to hear it. In a bull market, you're telling them, hey, you don't have to lower your stock allocation. Nobody wants to lower their stock allocation in a bull market. It's great marketing. But it's bad, bad stock investing. Bad, bad, bad stock investing. It'll crush you. It'll kill you. All right, so that's the simple case. Why rebalancing never works. Now, I want to take it a step further. The one flaw in that little argument I presented, and I think it's a powerful little argument. I think it's compelling. But there is one flaw. And that flaw is that I'm giving you extremes. The 8 P10 level that applied in 1982 is pretty darn low. It's about half of the fair value P10 level. And the 44 is insanely high. It's the highest we've ever seen. So I'm giving you extremes when I give you those numbers. Most of your investing life is not going to be lived at those extremes. We're not usually going to be at an 8 or at a 44. The fair value P10 level is 14/15. So we're usually going to be somewhere around there. Maybe we'll be at 13 or 12. Maybe we'll be at 17 or 18. Somewhere in that neighborhood. Not 44. Not 8. So the compelling example I gave to make the point is a little, I mean, it's not artificial in that it really did happen, and it happened in recent history. So I don't think it's totally artificial, but it's a little artificial. Those aren't the numbers that are usually going to apply. So I need to make the case with more usual numbers. Well, let's look at the difference between investing at a P10 level of 14 to investing at a, which is fair value, and it's roughly where we are today, and investing at 21, P10 level 21. 21 I would describe as the danger zone. Whenever you go above 20, stocks are starting to get dangerous. Below 20, stocks are a great buy. They're a better buy the lower you go, but anything up to 20, they're a great buy. 14 is fair value. 8 is obviously mouthwateringly great. 19 is still pretty darn good. You try the calculators and see what happens when you invest in stocks at a P10 level of 19. And the answer is you'll get good results, in my experience, using the calculators. When you get to 25, that's insane. There's never been a time that investing heavily in stocks at a 25 P10 level has ever worked. Four times in history we've gone to that level. The first time, everyone who followed rebalancing or passive investing suffered bone-crushing losses. The second time, everyone who followed rebalancing suffered bone-crushing losses. The third time, everyone who practiced rebalancing suffered bone-crushing losses. The fourth time, everyone who practiced rebalancing suffered bone-crushing losses. I am beginning to detect a pattern. You don't want to be heavily invested in stocks when the P10 level is 25. And guess what? It was 25 for almost the entire time period from 1996 through September 2008. Investing in stocks from that time period was living on borrowed time. We're not able to tell you when the stock crash is coming, but when you get to those P10 levels, we can tell you for sure that one is coming. It's going to wipe out your retirement account if you don't wise up and give up on this rebalancing nonsense. So says Rob Bennett anyway. It's what I believe. 25 is the danger zone. So below 20, stocks are great. Below 20, most of the conventional investing wisdom you've heard sort of applies. I still wouldn't say you should rebalance, even if we always stayed below 20, but you wouldn't go too far wrong. It wouldn't be such a disaster if you did that. You would do a little better by adjusting your stock allocation now and then. Certainly when we go below a P10 level of 12, it makes sense to increase it. But you wouldn't suffer any wipeouts. You probably would never suffer a wipeout if you rebalanced, if we always stayed below a P10 level of 20. Above 25, it's insane. You gotta lower your stock allocation, you have no choice. Between 20 and 25, I would call the danger zone. Sometimes, if you invest heavily in stocks at P10 level 20 or 21 or 22, you might get away with it. You might get lucky. Sometimes you'll get unlucky. Sometimes you'll get to 21, you'll have a big, big crash. So you can't be sure. I would pull a little off the... I at least think about pulling something off the table when you go above 20. But when you get to 25, you just have to pull the trigger. You have to do it without any question. According to the historical data. According to how stocks have always performed in the past. So let's compare fair value, 14. We're at 16 today. We're a little above fair value, not much. It's 14 and 16 are awfully close. And 21. Well, at 14, the most likely 10-year annualized real return is 6.3%. Pretty nice. About the average. Stocks on the long term provide an average return of roughly 6.5 real. At 21, the beginning of the danger zone, we're down to a most likely 10-year annualized real return of 2.7. Now, that's not awful. It's not awful. Some people would say, well, I there are a lot of people today who want to justify rebalancing. They want to justify rebalancing. And what they'll say is, oh, I can live with that. It's not so bad. I mean, why would you want to live with it if you could do better elsewhere? You know, that shouldn't be the analysis. I can live with it. But a lot of people really have an affection for rebalancing today, mainly because I think they don't want to admit having made a mistake. So that's a bad reason. But it's true that a 2.7 real return is not horrible. Now, you could do worse. That's the average. So you could do worse. But 2.7 is competitive with what you can get from, you know, Treasury inflation protected securities or I-bonds or certificates of deposit. My view is stocks are a more volatile asset class, which is another way of saying stocks are a more risky asset class. I want to be compensated for risk. I don't want to take the risky asset class unless I get a significantly better return than what I can get in a safe asset class. So if I could get, say, 2% real return from certificates of deposit and 2.7 real return from stocks, I go with the certificates of deposit. I'll give up 0.7% of return in exchange for a stable asset class, because stable asset classes are what make you rich, because you don't sell them. You don't suffer these wipeouts, and you don't suffer the emotional trauma that stocks can bring on. And so I prefer that, except when stocks offer a significantly better return, in which case I say, look, yeah, I'm willing to take on that instability. I'm willing to take on that risk in exchange for fair compensation for doing so, in exchange for the higher return. My rule of thumb is I want at least two percentage points better to justify going with stocks. So when stocks are providing 2.7 real, I would go with a non-stock asset class unless there was no asset class providing better than, say, 0.5 return. If the best I could get in TIPS and I-bonds and CDs was 0.5, I'd say, well, stocks are better by 2.2 percentage points a year. I'm going to go with stocks in that case. But If CDs were providing 1% real, I'd say, hey, stocks are only 1.7 better. I'm going with CDs. It's not worth me taking on that risk. This is just a rule of thumb. That's how I think about it. So, does rebalancing make sense then? even in the less dramatic scenario, it's a common scenario to move from, say, a 14 to a 21 P10 level, or from a 21 to a 14. I think that change is dramatic enough to say rebalancing does not make sense. The change from, see, 2.7 return, CDs can frequently beat that. And with the 2% adjustment. They can't always beat it without the 2% adjustment. But with the 2% adjustment, they can usually beat it. Almost always, really. All a CD would have to provide is 0.7% of return. Or TIPS or I-bonds. So stocks and the safe asset classes are competitive when prices get to the 2021 level. At the 14 level, they're not. Have you ever seen a CD or an I-bond that paid 6.34 real? Not 6.34 total. I've seen CDs that paid 7%. I had them. But they didn't pay 7% real. They paid 7% total. So you've got to subtract inflation. 6.34% is an awesome annual return. And at when stocks are priced at reasonable prices, my belief is that you should generally be going with, you know, a high stock allocation. Not all stocks, but a fairly, you know, fairly high stock allocation. Now, so what I did was I went through the historical data. I went back to 1920. So I looked at the modern era, and I went through year by year. And please don't quote me on what I'm going to report here, because I didn't look through it carefully the way I would if I were writing an article. This I consider podcasts a fairly informal medium. So I went through the numbers. But I didn't spend a lot of time. I probably spent 15 minutes on this exercise rather than, you know, properly. I should spend probably a couple hours. But I went through it quickly just to get an idea. And what I did was I went from 1920 through 1928 to see how many times I felt the PE10 level had changed enough that I should change my stock allocation. The purpose of the exercise was to say, does rebalancing ever work? Has there ever been a time period in the history of the market when rebalancing made sense? Now, obviously, rebalancing can work for a year or 2 years or 3 years. Obviously. Can work for 5 years, maybe 10 years. But you'll see as I go through these numbers, it's a rare circumstance for rebalancing to work more than 10 years. And isn't the idea to be a long-term investor, isn't that what John Bogle is always telling us? That's sure what I hear when I listen to him. And I believe it. I think he's right. He's right about that one. What he's wrong about is long-term investing is impossible. It's impossible as a practical matter for the investor practicing rebalancing. So I went through from 1920 forward and I looked at the changes in the P10 level, and I just scribbled down, you know, this is when I would change my stock allocation. Now, I tried to keep it simple. When I often do this exercise when I go through the calculator. There's a calculator called the Scenario Surfer, where you change your allocation as often as you want, and you go through a 30-year sequence. So I have to make these changes. There is no one set of rules to follow. I can't tell you you should always change your allocation at such and such a level, because it depends on a lot of different things. It depends on how risk-averse you are. It depends on what the alternative asset classes are offering. Obviously, at a time when TIPS are offering 4% real, you know, I would be inclined to switch to TIPS if the return on stocks went below 6% real, because that 2% differential wouldn't be in place. But there are other times when TIPS are only providing 1% real. Well, then I might go with stocks even if they were only providing, say, 3.5 real. I'd be a lot more demanding of the non-stock asset class when the non-stock asset class is just not offering a competitive return. So I can't give you one rule. There is no one rule. I've had people ask me that often, and it's a question that doesn't make sense. But I know, you know, we all know what TIPS and I-bonds and certificates of deposit generally offer. My take on this is that if you're smart, if you look for good deals and lock them in when they become available, lock them in for the long term, I think it's possible with alternative asset classes to get an annual real return of close to 3% real. Now, some would say no. Some would say that's a little too optimistic. I think it's reasonable. I locked in TIPS and I-bonds paying 3.5% real. So I've enjoyed something better than 3%. That deal is not usually available, but I don't think 3%. I also had CDs that were paying 7%, and after taking out inflation, I think inflation in the years when I held those was about 2%. So those CDs were paying about 5% real. So I think this can be done. But there are time periods when it cannot be done. That's certainly true. And when you mix them all together, I think 3% real is neighborhood, maybe a little on the optimistic side. Certainly 2% real is doable, certainly. So we can argue over whether 2% real is the number for non-stock or 3%. But you have to look at that in deciding whether to make a switch or not. And I didn't go back and look. You know, I didn't, when I was going through this exercise, I didn't look in 1926, you know, what was available. I just went by using the standard number in my head that the alternative asset class would provide something between 2 and 3% real, depending on the circumstances. And I went through, and another thing I did was, I practiced something that I think John Russell calls, I think he calls it latch and hold. And the idea is, and I always practiced this, I always thought this was a good idea, but when I change my allocation, say I'm working the calculator and I'm going through a 30-year sequence, 30-year return sequence. And say, you know, I don't know, say I start at a P10 level of 14 and I have a stock allocation of 70%. And the P10 level goes up to 21 and I'm nervous, thinking probably should be lowering my stock allocation, maybe to say to, you know, 40%. I often will not lower it when we first get to 20 or 21. I'll just stay, and I'll say, I want to make sure that we're going to stay above 20. In other words, you might get up to 20 one year, and then it might drop down to 17 the next year, and then I'll say, okay, you know, I can stay at 70. There's nothing wrong with 70% or 80%, whatever the number is. But if we go to 21 one year and then I stay with my 70% and then we jump to 24, well, then I'm going to drop. Then I'm going to maybe go down to 20% allocation or 30%. I'm going to say, wait a minute here. This is too high. So the point here is I try to limit the changes in my allocation. I don't change every time we cross a threshold. I'll sort of, you know, become alert to the need for change and then see whether that need is confirmed with the next year or the next 2 years of results. So I did the same thing as I went through the historical record. I didn't change the allocation every time. I didn't do it in a mechanical way. If you did it with a computer, you'd say, okay, you know, the rule is, tell the computer the rule is to change your allocation when you hit 20 or 21. And I don't think that's the way to go. I think you have to use some human judgment. You have to be somewhat mechanical. You have to be aware of the numbers, but the numbers should be informing your decisions, not dictating them. So I follow what I think of as a latch and hold. I think that's what John means by latch and hold. He's a lot more systematic about it than I am, but I think that's the basic concept. And I certainly follow that. So I followed that. And the other thing I did was I only used three allocations. I used 100% allocation when returns were just incredibly juicy. I used 70% for sort of the norm when stocks are at fair value or a bit above fair value, but not insanely dangerous. And I used 20% when stocks became insanely dangerous. So I only used three. Now, when I was using the calculator, I probably would vary. For example, today we're at a P10 level of 16. Under this approach, I would have a 70% allocation. In real life, I think we're at a dangerous 16 today, given that we're living in the wake of the most out-of-control bull market in history. My guess is we have another huge stock crash ahead of us in the next few years. So I personally would recommend something in the neighborhood of 50% stock allocation today. I do think you should be in stocks today. Stocks offer a much better value proposition today than they did before the crash. But I would hesitate to go to 70. I think 70 would be awful high for today. I lean towards 50, maybe even 40. I'm becoming a little more pessimistic. The longer we go on without a consensus that we need to move past passive investing, the more nervous I get that it's going to take another crash to sort of straighten things out. And if that's the case, I'd just as soon not be going with a high stock allocation. So in terms of this exercise, I would have put things at 70 at today's P10 level. But in real life, I wouldn't. So it's, you know, it's just like all our exercises of this nature, it's somewhat artificial. It's not exactly what I would do in real life. But the point was just to see in general how many changes you would have to make and whether there's ever been a time when rebalancing really made sense. Now, I'll just summarize it. I'll go through the years, but let me first summarize it. I ended up making 13 allocation changes in 89 years. And that comes to roughly one every 7 years. So valuation-informed indexing does not require many allocation changes. You're looking at roughly one change every 7 years. But that one change every 7 years leaves you with a much larger portfolio. This is what the calculators are for, to check that. Use the scenario surfer and you'll see it for yourself. It leaves you with a much, much bigger portfolio at the end of 30 years. In some cases, double. Now, double's extreme, but I have seen that happen. That's extreme. But it's not extreme to be able to retire 5 years sooner. You can't do more than 5 years. It's hard to retire 5 years sooner, frankly, because those last 5 years, you're making a lot of progress. Because your portfolio has built up a lot. So to get 5 years, to cut 5 years off is a lot. But it can be done with valuation-informed indexing. It's not at all impossible. You can cut 5 years, but you can't do more than that. And in some cases, you won't cut five, but you almost always end up ahead. You almost always cut, you know, two or three. Sometimes maybe a little more than five, but not too much. It's pretty hard. It's surprising how hard it is. I checked it out on the strategy tester, another calculator, and I think the reason is that when you get to the last 5 years, you've got such a big portfolio that you're really, those years, you make a lot of forward motion in those years because the compounding is so great. And so to cut off more than 5 years is like moving a mountain. It's really hard. But this is a pretty simple strategy to be able to cut 5 years off your, you know, the time it takes you to get to retirement. So you only need to make one change roughly every 7 years. Now, but the thing I really wanted to look at is how many years can you go without making a change? And what I was trying to answer was, what's the longest time period for which rebalancing has ever worked? Well, the longest that I see here is, 70, 40, 87, 85. The longest I think I see here is from 74 to 87. That's a time period of 13 years. And I made no allocation change. I was at 100% stocks in 74 because the numbers were just mouth-wateringly great. And they didn't get so high that I had to lower until 1987. But that's the longest time period. The next closest was from 1942 to 1954. That was 12 years. And again, in 1942, the numbers were mouth-wateringly great. I was at 100%, and I didn't go down to 70% until 1954. But the longest from 1920 through 2008, the longest that I was able to come up with where you wouldn't make an allocation change was 13 years. So the longest rebalancing has ever worked is 13 years. That's the best. Many times you had to make an allocation change after, you know, 2 years. But on average, you had to make one every 7 years in order to invest rationally. And the longest in history was 13 years. So I think it's fair to say rebalancing never works. Rebalancing is crazy. I'll just run through. I think it might be helpful just to run through quickly. I don't want to spend too much time on it because numbers are boring, you know? But I'll run through it quickly just to give an idea of how often you have to make these changes. From 1920 through 1926, we went from a P10 level of 6 to a P10 level 13. And I went from an allocation of 100, 100 makes sense, at a P10 level of 6, down to 70. So I made one change in those 6 years. From 1926 to 28, we went from a P10 level 13 to 25. Now you're in the insanely dangerous level. So I went from 70% to 20. So I made another change. From 1928 to 1930, we went from 25, insanely dangerous, back down to 16, which is fair value, where we are today. So then I made a change from 20% stocks to 70% stocks. From 1930 to 1931, I went from 16 P10 level to a 9 P10 level. Changed the allocation from 70% to 100% stocks. From 31 to 35, the P10 level went from 9 to 14, and I took the allocation from 100 down to 70. From 1935 to 1942, we went from 14, fair value P10 level, down to 9, mouth-wateringly delicious P10 level, and I took the allocation from 70% stocks to 100% stocks. From 1942 to 1954, a nice 12-year run, without having to change allocation, we went from a P10 level of 9 to a P10 level of 16, and I took the allocation from 100 down to 70%. 1954 to 1964, another long run, 10 years, we went from a P10 level of 16, fair value, to P10 level of 23, dangerous. And I went from a stock allocation of 70% to a stock allocation of 20%. From 1964 to 1969, the P10 level moved from 23 to 17, and I took the allocation from 20% stocks to 70% stocks. 1969 to 1974, we went from a P10 level of 17 down to a P10 level of 10, and I took the allocation from 70% up to 100%. 74 to 87, longest time period on record without a change needed in allocation, longest time period on record in which rebalancing worked for 13 years. The P10 level went from 10 to 15, and I took the allocation from 100% to 70%. 87 to 95, another fairly long run, 8 years, we went from a P10 level of 15 to a P10 level of 24, and I took it from a 70% allocation down to 20%. And then, of course, from 95 through 2008, that's another 13-year run. That's another 13-year run without a change. So we've had fewer changes in recent history. Went from a P10 level of 24 down to a P10 level of 16. We, of course, went to 16 in September with the crash. And I went from a P10 level of 20, which is where I think your stock allocation should have been during those insane price times, up to 70. You know, I went to 70 in this exercise. But as I say, in real life, I'd be inclined to go with maybe 50 today. But if you were looking at the numbers, certainly 70 makes sense. If you look at the long-term value proposition of stocks, 70% makes all the sense in the world today. But given that we're living in the wake of the most out-of-control bull market in history, I think you might want to think twice about going quite that high. So, that's the case. That's the case that rebalancing never works. There's no stock allocation that makes sense, both at a time when the long-term return is a negative 1% and at a time when the most likely long-term return is a positive 15% real. There's no allocation that makes sense in both circumstances. So rebalancing doesn't make sense. But even if you look at less dramatic scenarios, there's never been a time period of more than 13 years when it made sense not to make an allocation change. And the allocation changes I'm talking about in this exercise are fairly significant. I'm not talking about changing your allocation 5% or 10%. I'm talking about going from 70% stocks to 20% or from 20% to 70%. Those are big allocation changes. If you fail to make an allocation change of that size, you're going to suffer a wipeout. You're going to see your portfolio get crushed. Now, I wanted to focus in this podcast on the numbers. This is one of the numbers-oriented podcast. But I also wanted to add a little bit of non-number stuff, because I think the non-number stuff, the emotional side, is, in my personal opinion, the most important. And the real problem with rebalancing is it's a way of thinking about stocks. See, many ideas have implicit messages within them, buried within them. And rebalancing is one of those. Passive investing is one of those. Passive investing drives me crazy because most people hear the word passive investing and they hear neutral. Passive sounds neutral. And they think, oh, passive, that's just the neutral way to invest. That's just the moderate. And most middle-class investors want to be moderate. They don't want to be scared little kittens. They want to take on some risk because they know they have to if they're going to retire, if they want to have realistic hopes of retiring. But they don't want to take on insane levels of risk. Most middle-class investors do not. So they're aiming for moderation, and passive sounds moderate. The reality is passive is not moderate at all. It's extreme. It's an extreme approach to investing because you end up going with a 70% stock allocation at a time when the most likely long return is a negative number. What could be more extreme than that? That's where passive investing leads you. That's where rebalancing leads you. Well, how does it get you there? That's the question I'm always trying to understand. Why, valuation-informed indexing is so far superior to passive indexing. It lets everyone retire sooner. It would protect the economy from this economic crash that we're suffering. It's just a win-win-win-win-win in every possible way. And of course, I have to bang my head against the wall and I have to try to figure out, why is it so controversial? Why are there these people out there that are so upset about the idea that middle-class investors might learn this? And the answer is, human beings are creatures of habit. If there's one thing I've learned in my 52 years walking the Valley of Tears, is that we are not computers on legs. We are not these calculating machines that the economists often make us out to be. We're largely creatures of habit, even more than we are creatures of emotion. I always talk about how emotion influences us, and it does. But if I look at my own life, what has really caused me trouble throughout my life? It's habit. Why do we teach our children brush your teeth, after every meal? Because if they get in that habit, they'll do it for the rest of their life. And if they don't, they won't. If you get in the habit of exercising, you'll just go out every day. You can't stand to not exercise. But if you don't get in that habit, it's hard. If you get in the habit of eating right, eating vegetables and fruits, you'll eat well. Well, so many things are habit. If you get in the habit of watching television, you'll piss a large part of your life away. If you get in the habit of using bad language, it becomes hard to break. But if you get out of that habit, or if you never get in that habit, it's so much easier. Coffee is an awful habit for me. I wish I'd never drank my first cup of coffee, because I drink far too much and I'm addicted and I hate it. And I can't break the habit. Well, when you follow rebalancing, you're developing a habit. Because, I mentioned here, there are times when you can go 13 years and rebalancing works. There's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly rational to stay at the same stock allocation for 13 years, usually 7. But in the longest time period, it was 13. Well, if you do something for 13 years, you're going to feel awfully funny about changing after 13 years or after 7 years or whatever it happens to be. You're going to be in a habit. And habits reinforce themselves. And I think this is what happened in this bull market. We all knew that we were investing in a reckless, irresponsible, dangerous, self-defeating way. We all knew that on some level of consciousness. But we all were in the habit of rebalancing. And frankly, that habit was developed before we even knew about Shiller's research. It was developed back in the days when people thought the efficient market theory was real. So we've developed this habit. And what happened is, Rob Bennett came along and said, hey, this habit's a bad idea. And people freaked out. They said, it can't be a bad idea. I've been doing it for 30 years. It can't be a bad idea. Well, you could get away with investing. You could get away with rebalancing from 1975 through 1995 for 20 years. Now, I mentioned, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, there should have been an allocation change in there, but it wasn't so critical. The allocation change was going from 100% stocks to 70. Well, if you had just gone with 70 the whole time, you would have been okay. So that would be 20 years. But in 96, you had to change that allocation, or you were letting your risk level just go off the charts. You're a moderate risk investor, and you were investing like you're at a casino from 96 forward. And sooner or later, you're going to get burned. Well, you can't wait until 1996 and then have somebody tell you, hey, this is dangerous. Somebody tells you, hey, this is dangerous in 96, you're going to tune it out. And that's what happened to millions of us in the pre-crash period and the crash. We developed a bad habit. We developed a habit of rebalancing. We developed a habit of believing in passive investing. And that meant more to us. Human behavior is more influenced by habit than it is by logic. So while all the logic argued against rebalancing, it became very, very, very hard for us to break that habit. So my primary case against rebalancing is the numbers. It just doesn't make sense. Well, the logic and the numbers are the two things. But a third argument is it's a bad habit to pick up. You don't want to start thinking that stocks are an asset class where you don't need to change your allocation, because if you get in that habit, it'll be hard to break and you'll get killed. It's like getting the habit of driving drunk. You know, you can drive drunk and not get in an accident, but if it becomes a habit, you're almost sure to kill yourself sooner or later. And that's what happened to all the people that got crushed in this crash. They got to a point where they had been rebalancing for so long, they just couldn't bear to acknowledge how irrational it is. And they tuned out the message. Shiller published his book. It was a bestseller. A lot of these experts who recommended rebalancing, they knew about the book. They raved about it. But they had picked up the rebalancing habit, and they weren't able to break it. They're humans like all the rest of us. We need to learn from this, not to make this mistake again. Another problem, aside from the habit, is you develop deep, what I call deep shame. If you rebalance for 7 years or 13 years or 20 years, during that time, you're going to be talking with other people about your stock investing experiences. Your spouse, your husband or wife, your friends, your coworkers, your neighbors, community members on discussion boards, and you're going to be telling them that rebalancing is good. And then when you learn, you read an article by Shiller or somebody else, you use one of the calculators of the website, and you find out rebalancing doesn't make any sense at all, you're not going to want to change, because you're going to be remembering what you've done to your friends and your loved ones and your neighbors, and you're not going to want to acknowledge the error. This is what we're living through today. We're living through a time where the record is as clear as it could be that rebalancing can never work, but millions are struggling with acknowledging this. Them feel stupid. It's as if, you know, the stock selling industry had been pushing, trying to flap your wings and fly for 30 years, and people have been walking down the street flapping their wings for 30 years, and Rob Bennett comes along on a discussion board and says, hey, you know what? Gravity exists, and we can't fly by flapping our wings. And people become angry. They say, what? You mean I've been looking like a fool for 30 years? You know, get rid of this guy. Ban this guy. We can't have this guy saying this. He makes us look like damn fools. Well, that's not my intent. It's not my intent. But the problem with rebalancing is it's not only a mistake, it's an obvious mistake, painfully obvious mistake. And people don't like to look dumb. So it causes not only deep shame, it makes you feel deeply ignorant. Now, it doesn't mean you are deeply ignorant. Many, many, many of the smartest people in the world have practiced rebalancing. So you're in good company if you did it. But it's hard to shake. It's hard to shake because it does make you feel bad. So we're now living through a time where we have to shake this rebalancing trap, and you know, the obvious question is, what's it going to take? And I believe what it's going to take is suffering. You know, it's hard to accept, but that seems to be the case. And we made a lot of progress with the stock crash. There's a lot more openness to realistic investing ideas since the crash, but it appears as though it's going to take another crash to get us to the other side, another big crash. So all I can say is that those of us who understand the realities need to work together to prepare so that we can provide people with the best information possible for when they become able to listen to the more realistic story. We've got to prepare. Because if we don't, the entire economy could go over a cliff. Another 50% price crash is going to hit the middle-class investor hard. And it's going to be hard to recover. It's going to be hard to recover from that. If the slate, say we were starting today, say there were no history of stock investing, and starting today we were all going to decide what's the best way to invest, I don't think there's one person on planet Earth who would recommend rebalancing. Rebalancing makes no sense. It's pure self-destruction. The reason why we can't give it up is because we've done it so much, and we've caused such pain, and we can't forgive ourselves, and we can't accept what we've done. We can't say those magic words, I was wrong. But there is no reason, there is no logic for rebalancing. If you practice rebalancing, I challenge you. Please tell me a reason. Tell me why it's a good idea to stay with the same stock allocation at all price levels. And if you can come up with something, please go to the website, look for the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page. Send me an email. Let me know, and I'll share it with with my listeners and my readers. I don't think that I've asked enough people that question that I'm convinced at this point there is no justification for rebalancing. Rebalancing never works. It never makes sense. The last point I wanted to make is, I think it's the last point. Looking quickly at my notes, rebalancing causes you to sell at the worst possible time. I've talked before about Taylor Larimore. He's the co-author of The Boglehead's Guide to Investing. And Taylor has said, if stock prices drop any lower, he's going to have to go to a zero stock allocation. Now, Taylor had never intended to go to a zero stock allocation. What happened is he was practicing rebalancing for years. And so the risk that he was taking on with his stock investments had just gone to insane levels, levels he had never intended back at the time when he adopted his allocation. And so now he suffered devastating losses that he was totally unprepared for. And he's still hanging on. He's trying to hang on. Another big stock crash is going to shake Taylor Larimore loose, and it's going to shake millions of others loose. See, this is the history of stock investing. If you follow the historical data, what happens is people come to believe in rebalancing / passive investing, but it never works. So in theory, these people are thinking, I'm going to get this magical 6.5% real return that I hear stocks give on average. Well, stocks give that return, but not to those who practice rebalancing, because rebalancing means you get thrown off the horse at the worst possible time. It ensures that stock crashes are just, they're essentially like clockwork. Prices go too high, you're going to have a stock crash. We don't know how long it's going to take for prices to go to insane levels again, but I know that if you start practicing rebalancing today, there's going to come a time in your investing lifetime when we're going to be at insane price levels again, and you will have developed a habit by the time we get there that you won't be able to break. So you'll lose all your money once again. If you break the rebalancing habit today, you can get on the other track. You can get on the rational track. And please look at the strategy tester, a calculator at the site, and it shows you. You can make back all the money you lost in the crash if only you will switch to valuation-informed indexing today. You won't make it all back in 1 week. You'll make it back over the course of 30 years. That's how much better your return is likely to be over the next 3 decades. So you can make this money back. But if you stick with rebalancing / passive, you'll lose it all again, most likely. You'll probably lose it in another stock crash in the next year or two or three. Then you'll be out of stocks, for 5-10 years while they're generating huge returns. Then you'll get in again and lose it all again. This is the path. This is the path of the passive rebalancing investor. Always getting in at the wrong time, always getting out at the wrong time, because it's an emotional strategy. There is no logic to it. There is no common sense to it. When you decide to rebalance, you're giving in to emotion. and that emotion's going to become a habit, and that emotion's going to kill you in the end. So I don't recommend it. They have never, the passive investing advocates have never identified one investor who ever followed rebalancing for 30 years and obtained a good result. I've never heard of one. They talked about people who did great during the bull market, say from 75 to 95, they sure produced a lot of those, or even 75 through 2000, they produced a lot of those, but that's not 30 years. Starting in 2000, stocks have performed very poorly. I say, see, certificates of deposit have beaten stocks dating back to 94. So stocks have been performing poorly for a long time. Rebalancing hasn't made sense for a long time. It's never made sense. It makes sense for short little periods of history, and that it always fails. And you're not going to be able to know when to jump off the train. Don't think you're going to be so smart that you'll know when to change. You have to develop a habit of investing rationally. Rebalancing never works. What's really going on is what Artie pointed out at the blog the other week. And he said the key, and I did a podcast on this. I don't recall the number, but it was a recent one. I did a podcast on this, and I said, I called it something like, I can teach you how to lose money in a bull market. And it's, of course, a deliberately, facetious title. But there's a truth being expressed there. And Artie brought this out in a wonderful comment he put at the blog. The key to successful long-term investing is being willing to underperform your fellow investors for short periods of time. If you're willing to underperform, you can get great results in the long term. But you've got to accept that. If you can't, the rational investor did poorly from 96 through 99, 4 years. We did great from 75 through 95. We did just as well as the passives. We all did great. From 96 through 99, the passives did far, far better. And from 2000 through 2009, the rationals did better. And on an overall basis, the rationals are far ahead today and will go even farther ahead in the future as they obtain compounding returns on the differential by which they're ahead. But the key to making the whole thing work was you had to understand the ABCs of stock investing well enough so that from 96 through 99, you did not feel a temptation to rebalance. You lowered your stock allocation because the risk of stocks was insanely high and you didn't feel a temptation to reverse that decision. Now, the last point, the really last point, is a practical one. All this sounds great, but how do we do it in the real world? How do we get to a point where we never again feel this temptation to rebalance? The answer is you can't do it alone. You know, they have these, what is this group? Weight Watchers, where people try to lose weight and they get together. And of course, all the 12-step programs do this. They all sort of, whatever their problem is, drug addiction or alcohol addiction, they talk about the problem. Well, the reason these things work, and we do this in areas where, there's no bad behavior involved. We do this with sports. We do it with politics. The way we learn about any subject as humans is we talk it over. We talk it over with friends. And what we need to do to break the rebalancing habit is we need to share. We need to share. We need to reinforce. If you understand the logic of what I've put forward in this podcast, you've sort of got halfway there, but you haven't totally turned the key. Understanding it on a logical basis is good. It's good. And that's what I do. But that won't get you all the way there. You need to have that message reinforced. Otherwise, the next time we go to an insane bull market where prices go up and stocks become insanely dangerous, you're going to get pulled in by all the messages of the stock selling industry telling you buy stocks now, even though the long-term value proposition is a negative number. That's what's going to happen. But if we set up discussion boards on the internet where we can share with each other, no, I'm not falling for this stock selling industry garbage. Here's what the historical data says. Here's what the calculator says. I'm not falling for it. Look at what's happened through history to people who have fallen for this. Then we back each other up. Then we achieve financial freedom years sooner. So rebalancing is the enemy. Passive investing is the enemy. Rebalancing is just the implementation of passive investing. We can't fight it alone. We need to fight it as a community. Rebalancing never, ever, ever, ever works. I hope you'll check out the other podcasts at the site and the articles and the calculators and find out more about why rebalancing never works and what we have to do to shake the rebalancing habit and to become rational investors in future days. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.